Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Daniel Freeberg. He has a new book out from Arctos called The Real Right Returns. He is the CEO of the Swedish mining company Viking Mineral, and he was also a founder of the Swedish Meadow political think tank Motpol. You were also one of the co-founders of Arctos. Daniel, it's great having you on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to start off, can you just tell us a little bit about your background? How did you start off in life, and how did you start to develop a lot of your views that you have now? You mentioned earlier one of your experiences was your experiences going into school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, like many other Swedish people of my generation, I was brought up by the generation of 68, so to speak. My parents belonged to that generation and were therefore quite leftist, and I had quite a leftist upbringing, and I was submitted to quite a lot of leftist indoctrination during my early childhood, both through or maybe primarily through popular culture and through the Swedish school system, which by international standards are extremely leftist. It's probably hard for an American to imagine what kind of craziness has been going on in Sweden for the recent decades. But
would you say that Sweden is probably one of the most leftist countries in the world?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely the most crazy leftist country in the world. I mean, it's not leftist in a so-called good way, within quotes, because I don't really believe there is any good way. But I mean, North Korea would probably be better. I mean, than the type of leftism we have in Sweden, because we have the craziest variety of leftism. It's like pure cultural Marxism on steroids.
Well, North Korea, interestingly enough, it's communist, but there's also like a nationalist element to it. They still identify as like a Korean country.
Exactly, and they would never ever come up with crazy ideas like mass immigration, multiculturalism, or like gender studies or stuff like that. So North Korea is definitely a better kind of leftism than the kind Sweden has been suffering under for the past 40 years or so. And I was no exception. I mean, growing up in that environment, I was submitted to these ideas from an early age. I mean, everything from comic books to children's programs on TV, and even my parents, unfortunately, submitted me to these crazy leftist ideas. So up until the age of maybe 13 or so, I consider myself to be a leftist and an anti-racist as well. I thought of myself as a very good person, and I wore these anti-racist pins and so forth. And I think that the only reason that was possible was because I actually had the good luck to grow up in a pretty harmonious and homogeneous neighborhood with basically only Swedes. So I didn't really have any personal experiences with a multicultural society and with immigration until I reached my early teens. And when I did, it was a kind of a brutal awakening for me, because what I experienced in my daily life when I started junior high and which was a new school with about 30% immigrants, most of them were from the Middle East and Africa. It was very different from what I've been taught during my my early years, and I came there with a completely open mind. So the leftist myth that right wingers or critics of multiculturalism and immigration are prejudiced is totally false, because I didn't have any prejudice whatsoever. I mean, if anything, I had prejudice in the other direction, they were better and kinder and nicer than Swedish people, and I quickly realized that was not the case, and it was a rude awakening, and I'm very happy for that experience, because it made me start to question a lot of things that I've been taught throughout school and throughout my from my parents and so forth, and I started doing some.
You were in school. Did the different groups, did they all segregate themselves, or were there was it common for people to be friends with different groups, or did everyone sort of segregate themselves along ethnic lines?
Everyone was very much segregated, absolutely, with a few exceptions, in the beginning at least. I mean, it was a new situation, and I actually started, I gave it a try, I gave it an honest try, this whole big happy family of different ethnicities myth that the left is trying to sell to us. And I actually befriended some of these immigrant students, and an experiment that I stopped quite quickly, because I realized that, well, these people are very different from us. They don't respect Swedish culture, they don't respect Swedish people, and I have very little in common with them. And I realized that, well, the whole leftist myth that we are all the same is totally false, because we're not. We're very different, and we have different preferences, we have different values, and segregation is obviously what we need and what is best for everyone, and therefore I went back to kind of just associating with other Swedish people, and there were a lot of ethnical conflicts at my school between immigrants and Swedish people, and it was a very chaotic environment, very difficult to actually learn something in that kind of environment, and that situation has kind of persisted and even deteriorated in Sweden since at a rapid pace. I mean, Swedish schools today are a total nightmare. They have degraded to the point where it's almost impossible to learn anything of value, and from Swedish school system has gone from being among the best in the world, educating the most brilliant scientists and brilliant innovators in the world, to being a pretty much worthless system, which don't really manages to educate anyone in anything of value at all, because it's. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Idiocracy.
Yes, I very am so.
Yeah. That is a very good depiction of what the Swedish school system has turned into, because it's making people more stupid, and they have to lower the standards for admittance into the higher educations for every year, because the people coming from high school and so forth are getting worse and worse and more stupid and more stupid for every year, and
you're not just talking about the foreign students, you're talking about the Swedish students as well.
Yeah, of course. The foreign students rarely even go to university, so they are not really relevant in that particular issue. But I'm talking about the Swedish students, because the Swedish school system has degraded so far, much due to multiculturalism, and because of this chaotic environment and the sort of extreme egalitarian perspective that the Swedish school system applies, where no one is allowed to be smarter than anyone else, and in a system like that, when you introduce a large number of Africans, for example, the standards are lowered quite a lot, and the end result is much more stupid graduates that are hardly even capable of getting into university unless you lower the standards quite a lot.
I was reading somewhere, so Sweden, well, in sheer numbers, like the United States takes in the most immigrants for any part of the world based on numbers, but per capita, Sweden, I think, takes in the most number of immigrants of any Western country.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe even any country in the world, but absolutely any Western country. It's totally extreme. I mean, Sweden is a quite small country with a small population. We are about roughly above 9 million. We are getting close to 10 million due to the horrible mass immigration, of which maybe 8 million currently are actual Swedish people. The rest are mostly non-Europeans. We are taking in, for this small population, the very fact that we are taking in this year about 300,000 migrants that from the Middle East and from Africa, that's over 3% of the population. That's quite extreme.
And 3,000 a year. 3% of the population increase each year.
Yeah, 300,000 this year, and last year maybe 150,000, and it's been above 100,000 for the past 2 decades roughly. So what we have is a situation with very rapid replacement of the indigenous population in Sweden, where we replace them with migrants from the Middle East and from Africa primarily.
What do you think about the whole sort of, there's like the frog in the boiling pan theory, where if changes happen gradually, people get used to it. What do you think about the argument that if all this stuff going on in Europe right now, it's happening at such a rapid pace that it's shocking people and waking them up? Do you see that as a good thing, or do you disagree with that theory?
No, I totally agree with that theory. I think of course, it's a horrible thing, in essence, but in reality, I'm very grateful that everything is happening so fast now, because it's not, I'm very, very well familiar with the theory of slowly boiling the frog until he doesn't realize it and jump out of the pan or whatever, and that is basically what has been going on up until recently in Europe. The slow process, trying to get people to get used to it gradually. But what's happening now is like turning up the heat like 500%, and people are getting terrified and they are reacting quite a lot. What we see now in Europe is a beginning of a popular uprising that we haven't seen in a very long time, and that makes me very happy, because I understand why the left is doing this, why they are allowing this, because they know that their ideas have failed, and they know that their days are numbered in Europe, because everyone can see what their horrible, stupid ideas result in, because we have the we we can see the reality around us, and we can see that, okay, this is what their ideas result in. So obviously their ideas are faulty. We don't even have to debate them on this topic, because we can see it with our own eyes. So what they are doing now, they are feeling that they are losing the grip they are losing the control of the popular opinion. So what they're trying to do is just trying to do as much damage as possible in as short time as possible. And of course it has some disadvantages. For example, it creates a lot of chaos, and it certainly provides a very, very viable risk for large-scale bloody ethnical conflicts throughout Western Europe. But it also wakes people up and terrifies a lot of people. That it kind of shocks people into reality, back into reality from this leftist fantasy world that they have been brought up into. On the whole, I think it's a good thing, and I think it's something we should definitely use to our advantage by increasing our increasing. We should put in an extra gear and increase our efforts to awakening the people, because now is the time. It's actually an historical moment for us in Western Europe to really tip the scales to our advantage if we play our cards right.
And there's been such a big backlash. There's been the arson attacks on the new refugee centers that they're building, and I know a lot of election polls have been showing, like, there's like the Swedish Democrats, their numbers are surging. Marine Le Pen has a very good chance of being elected next president of France. In Switzerland, the Swedish, I think it's not the Swedish, the Swiss People's Party won an election there.
Yes, yeah, and this trend is consistent all over Europe. I mean, in Poland recently, a right-wing conservative party, quite radical, won the election with a big margin, and we can see that our ideas are gaining ground all over Europe, and it's much thanks to this so-called migrant situation, which is an invasion, really. It's an invasion. I mean, it's even, if you listen to for example, many of the Islamic leaders, it's a conscious invasion. They are sending jihadists into Europe because they want to Islamicize Europe, and they're quite open about it. The only reason some people still haven't realized it in the West is because our completely dishonest mainstream media are keeping silent about it. Fortunately for us, the mainstream media is going down. They're losing readership with every day, and alternative media is gaining more and more ground with every day, at an increasing pace, even at an exponential rate, I would say. So it's a very interesting situation building up, and I can see a lot of interesting and exciting things happening in the near future that will definitely determine the fate of Europe, and therefore I'm very happy to be able to be active in this important age and time in history.
In regards to the issue of Islam, do you see it as just an issue of immigration, or do you see Islam as explicitly a threat as a religion?
Well, I think it's all tied together. I mean, I wouldn't want any non-European immigration, regardless if they are Muslims or Christian, of course. But when it comes to Muslim immigrants, we have a whole other aspect that we have to kind of bear in mind, and that is that they have, many of them view it as their mission to make Europe they want to Islamicize Europe, and they are more ideologically driven towards this goal, while most other non-European immigrants from, for example, Christian backgrounds, they are pretty much just in it for the money. They just come for the financial benefits. So in some regard, they are a bit more harmless because they're less organized and they are pretty much just opportunists, and they will be much easier to get rid of because they don't have this ideological agenda to kind of take over Europe. But of course, when it comes to crime and when it comes to a lot of other harmful effects on society, I don't really make any... I can't really... If you look at the statistics, you can't really notice much of a difference between Muslim and Christian non-European immigrants. So, yeah.
I was reading somewhere that a lot of Assyrian Christians from the Middle East are supporting the Swedish Democrat Party. Is that true?
Well, yes. Yeah, some of them are, of course, because they are also very anti-Islamic. But that doesn't change the fact that they, as a group in general, behave very badly in Swedish society, and they commit a lot of crime, and they commit a lot of rape, especially sexual violence and violence in general. They are completely overrepresented. So, well, if they support the Sweden Democrats, good for them, but I still don't want them in Sweden either way. I mean, I think they should just go back home as soon as Russia hopefully manages to stabilize Syria and stabilize the Assad regime. I think all of them should basically just go back home.
Do you think that with this whole situation, it will weaken the legitimacy of the EU? I know a lot of Eastern European countries like Poland and Hungary that have traditionally been hostile towards Russia are now developing closer ties towards Russia.
Yeah, for good reason. I mean, Russia is the only big international player that are actually acting responsibly in some way. I mean, the U.S. foreign policy has been a disaster. It's been a total disaster. They managed to destabilize a lot of fairly functional countries in the Middle East, North Africa, for example, Libya, Iraq, and so forth, and now Syria, of course. I mean, the whole advent of ISIS is mostly due to the support. It's a result, more or less, of the support that the U.S. have given these so-called moderate rebels, which are now joined with ISIS. And ISIS are using, I mean, firearms and weaponry and equipment that they have received from the U.S. So I would say that ISIS, well, the Islamic State, actually, I don't really like the term ISIS because it kind of insults the great Egyptian goddess of ISIS. So I don't think they deserve to be called ISIS. The Islamic State or Daesh is a more proper name for them.
Yeah, and I think Daesh is what they call themselves. I think ISIS or ISIL, Islamic States of Iraq and the Levant, I think that was coined by like Western journalists.
Yeah, it was. In any way, the Islamic State wouldn't have been possible without the destabilization of Iraq and the partial destabilization of Syria, which is a direct result of U.S. foreign policy and NATO foreign policy. And also the support and the generous donations of equipment and firearms and stuff like that. Because these people are basically savages playing with the white man's toys. They wouldn't have had a chance if they... I mean, they're obviously not capable of building any civilization of their own or even manufacturing functional or efficient weapons of their own. What they have in terms of firepower is is what they've been given by the U.S. basically. So I'm very happy that Russia has now recently stepped in and actually doing an efficient some efficient work in taking out the Islamic State, and I hope that they will wipe them out completely, so we can have some stability in the region again, and there will be no more reason for Syrians to stay in Europe, because the region will be stable and nice and harmonious, and we can just, yeah, it will be easier to just send them back.
And the propaganda put out by American conservatives or the pro-American right within Europe as well, is that America is this defender of Western civilization against radical Islam. But I mean, American influence is a major threat to Europe. American influence has changed the culture and political situation in Europe, but also America is largely responsible for creating this crisis that we're talking about in the Middle East that's bringing about these refugees. Do you see American influence as a threat to Europe?
Absolutely. I love the American people, and I think there are a lot of very, very positive aspects in American society. For example, your gun laws. I really love them. And I think we should have the same in Europe. I mean, every man should have the right to
Some European countries
arms.
Do, like Switzerland and a lot of Eastern European countries.
Yeah, but it's very rare in Europe as a whole. We have very strict weapon laws, which make our citizens kind of defenseless against these criminal gangs that are now roaming free in our territories. Back to the topic at hand. I appreciate a lot of things about America, and especially the American people, but when it comes to the American elites, which is something entirely different, which I think you agree with me on, I definitely think that they are not a defender of Western civilization. They are an enemy of Western civilization, and they are definitely an enemy of Europe. And they have been acting accordingly since the end of the Second World War. Basically, they have taken every chance they've gotten to undermine the independence of Europe and the possibility of Europe to become independent. I mean, after the Second World War, Europe was pretty much divided. It was occupied and divided between the Soviet bloc and the U.S. So we had Western Europe, which was more or less under U.S. occupation, even if it was like implicitly. We had some U.S. military bases, and we had free access to American popular culture. It was more of a cultural occupation, really, more than a military one, while the Eastern Bloc was more more explicitly occupied, of course, by communism, and both of these. I mean, the Soviet does not exist anymore, the Soviet Union, so they are not really a threat. And today's Russia is something very different from the Soviet Union, and I don't view Russia really as a significant threat to European independence. But the U.S. still is, because the U.S. The U.S. elite, whenever they get the chance, they do their best to undermine the strength of Europe, and for example, they have been pretty much in every possible scenario. They have taken a stance that has been very anti-European. They have been, I mean, for example, Obama and even Bush, I think, especially Clinton, have been promoting Turkey to become a member state in the European Union, and Turkey is an Islamic state, and it's not even situated in Europe, and the small part of Turkey that is within the European borders is due to their previous occupation. I mean, it's occupied territories. If anything, we should take it back.
As Turkey is a member of NATO, so if Turkey provokes something with Russia, that could get NATO dragged into a conflict with Russia.
Yeah, of course, and I don't view Turkey as a friend of Europe. Quite the contrary. It's a long time historical enemy of Europe. I mean, large parts of Europe, especially the southeastern parts, have suffered under Turkish occupation or the Ottoman Empire's occupation, and we've had a lot of. I mean, Turkey has been played a major part in the white slavery, sex slavery taking place, where they pretty much take European women from Ukraine, from the Balkans, and so forth, and funnel them into the Islamic world to serve as sex slaves. So no, Turkey is definitely an historical enemy of Europe, and the very idea of admitting these people into the European Union is a hostile act towards Europe, and the U.S. have been promoting this for quite a long time, which is only one thing of many things that the U.S. have done to undermine Europe. I mean, the destabilization of Syria, for example, it's definitely a bad thing for Europe, because Europe is now taking all the consequences of this destabilization, because we are getting this horrible stream of migrants, of which many are jihadists from the Islamic State. So. I would definitely say that the U.S. elite is definitely not a friend of Europe, quite opposite.
If you look at the countries, the American neocons view Iran as like the biggest threat to the West. I mean, out of all those countries, if you look at like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran is probably poses like the least of. Iran's probably the most reasonable out of all those countries.
Yeah, absolutely. For many reasons. I mean, for once, they have they don't have this jihadi culture, which is not very common among the Shiites, among the Muslims, and they are fundamentally an Indo-European people. They are not Arabs. Which means that they have some sort of identification with European peoples. They have some sort of kinship with us. So they are definitely not a threat to Europe, and they have never been really. Saudi Arabia, on the other hand, which is one of the most extreme Islamic Sunni Muslim countries in the world, Well, when it comes to these fantastic liberal values that the U.S. Claims to represent, I mean, Saudi Arabia is pretty much the polar opposite to those values. I mean, they don't even allow women to drive, and they execute rape victims, basically. Women who have been subjected to rape are stoned to death and stuff like that. And they are still allies of the U.S. The U.S. sees no reason whatsoever to depose the Saudi king, because it doesn't serve the U.S. geopolitical interests. But the secular leader, Assad, for example, I mean, Syria is compared to Saudi Arabia, it's a very secular, civilized, westernized country with religious tolerance, with some sort of protection of minorities and so forth. They don't burn Christian churches. I mean, Saudi Arabia doesn't even allow Christian churches, and it's actually punishable quite harshly to even display Christian symbols. You're not even allowed to celebrate Christmas, basically, in Saudi Arabia. And I know this because I've been living there for a short while, since some of my relatives used to work there for 20 years and lived there. So I really know what I'm talking about when it comes to Saudi Arabia. And they are one of the most important allies of the U.S. So there's definitely some hypocrisy and double standard going on here when they view Assad as a big threat to like Western values and humanitarian values and whatsoever. But they are really turn a blind eye when it comes to all the atrocities that are committed by the Saudi government.
I mean, you could see a conflict. I do think that, Islam, especially like the Salafism, is a major threat, but it's a little too simplistic to divide geopolitics to say Islam versus the West. There could be like a scenario if a major conflict where on one side you could have European nationalists, Russia, Bashar Assad, and Iran, and on the other side you could have the United States, the NATO powers, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Israel on the other side. So geopolitical conflicts are complex. They're not always that simplistic.
Absolutely, I agree. They are pretty much always complex. But I think the main thing is to, at least for me, is to look at what benefits European interests in these different scenarios the most, because that is where my loyalties lie. I mean, in the broader sense, of course, my loyalty is to the West as a whole. Since I'm a Swedish person, I have to, and since Europe is very much in dire straits right now. I mean, we are, as a continent, facing a very big threat. Of course, my primary loyalty is to Europe, and of course my home country is Sweden. But in geopolitical conflicts, the U.S. have unfortunately found itself on the opposite side of what is serving European interests in pretty much every geopolitical conflict during the past decade at least, or maybe the last two decades.
I want to talk about the definition of right and left. The title of your book is The Real Right Returns, and we talked about how those labels can be confusing. In the United States, the American right is an alliance between like business interests that wants lower taxes on business deregulation, and the religious right, which is focused primarily just on issues like abortion, gay marriage. And then there are also the term left is confusing because you have, on one hand, you have what a lot of people call cultural Marxism, but many cultural Marxists embrace consumerism and, I guess, capitalism even. And on the other hand, you could be a communist and still have nationalist or social conservative values. So I think these labels like left versus right can be confusing. You actually do have a metapolitical dictionary where you have your own definitions of all these different terms in your book.
Well, yes, I do, and it's not only my own definitions. It's definitions that I at least mostly share with the broader new right, if you're familiar with that phenomenon in Europe. But when it comes to consumerism, I view it as a part of liberalism, ideologically, and liberalism is very much leftist ideology in my view, and that is also why the title of my book is not The Right Returns, it's The Real Right Returns, because there is a huge difference between the real right and the fake right. I mean, most of Republicans are to me, and this term is actually something very innovative, and I like it a lot, conservatives, basically, and we have a lot of those in Europe,
yeah,
as well. We have a lot of fake rightists. I mean, they are totally pro-capitalism and they are pro-consumerism, and in some regards they want to lower the taxes a little bit if you're lucky, and then get rid of the welfare state maybe if you're really lucky, but few of them even dare to venture into that territory, but when it comes to everything else, they subscribe to pretty much the whole cultural Marxist package. I mean, the whole cultural Marxist ideological package, which includes multiculturalism, feminism, gay rights, everything that is currently destroying European and Western societies from within. So, of course, they are not real rightists. They are leftists masquerading as rightists, and they are total conservatives because they are not looking out for their own people's interests. They are serving other people's interests at their own people's expense, and it's time for us to clarify that. And
but it's interesting you bring up like conservatives, because Angela Merkel in Germany, she originally got elected as a conservative.
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely a conservative, and she even calls herself a Christian Democrat, which is hilarious because she's probably neither. I mean, neither Christian nor a Democrat, and she is a total traitor to her people. And when it comes to Germany, it's very interesting because their Christian Democratic Party is kind of a coalition between the northern CDU and the southern CSU, and the CSU is actually real conservatives, and the CDU are, well, they are liberals.
I know there are people within her own party that are strongly opposed to what she's doing, like prominent politicians.
Yes. Yeah, and I hope that she will be. I hope that she will eventually be forced to resign for her treason against her own people when it comes to the migrant situation, because that is what it is. And if you're supposed to be a conservative, you have some sort of responsibilities, and one of those are looking out for your own people's interests. And she's definitely not doing that. She's not doing a very good job at that. So I think her days are numbered as a politician in Germany after what she's done. And I'm very happy about that fact, of course, because I never really liked her anyway. She's a horrible, horrible person.
So in your book, you talk about the importance of metapolitics. What do you think is more important to focus on, organizing political parties or metapolitics, which is educating people and changing the political discourse through education?
Metapolitics, of course. I mean, that is one of the main points I discuss in my book. Metapolitics is actually the key to transforming the society into the direction you want, and that is something that we have seen the left being very successful at, and we can see the result of that in Europe today. We don't have any real right-wing parties anymore. We have some sort of fake right that subscribes to the whole cultural Marxist ideological package, and they're pretending to be right by wanting to lower taxes a little bit or something, and that is solely due to the successful metapolitics of the left. So yeah, metapolitics is definitely what we should focus on.
You have a chapter in your book, The Left's Cultural War of Conquest, and you talk about how they have like private NGOs, and they change the culture through control of education and the media.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is more visible in Europe than in the U.S. But the revolution of 68. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with that term at least. But it really affected European society. I mean, Western European society. Quite a lot, because that's when the left, the worst kind of left you can imagine. I mean, the Western Marxists, if you will, started to apply this metapolitical strategy that was pretty much invented by the Italian Marxist Gramsci. Which means that you have to really reshape the culture before you can accomplish any significant political change, and that is what they've been doing for the last half century. They have been infiltrating pretty much all of the cultural institutions, all of the media. Of course, with the help of the elites. They didn't really have to fight a lot to gain their position. They are now the doors were open. They were wide open. The media owners welcomed them. So it was very easy for them. They just basically had to step in.
Corporate interests? And corporate greed for cheap labor as being a primary driving force. I think it very much is in the United States. Would you say that's true in Europe?
United States, of course. Yeah, I can see that as a very significant factor. Absolutely. But in Europe, not so much, because the corporations are suffering immensely due to this situation as well. They're basically forced to move all of their production abroad, which I know is also not that uncommon in the U.S. But in Western Europe, especially, it's very apparent that due to the leftist politics, it's very very difficult to compete on the international market. So many. Or even most of the industries in, for example, Sweden are moving abroad to low cost countries, primarily in Asia, and as a result we get a whole different economy with mostly service sectors. That's pretty much what we have, which is a very bad thing.
In the case of Germany, I know if you compare Germany and England. England's economy center, England has shifted their manufacturing sector overseas, and their economy has stagnated, and their economy is based on finance, which just benefits the ultra-rich. I know part of the reason that Germany is an economic powerhouse is because they have a lot of manufacturing of high-end goods, like, will they make luxury cars, like Mercedes, BMWs, but also a lot of kitchen appliances?
Yeah, of course. And actually, Sweden and Germany are not that different, except Sweden is much worse off because we used to have that. I mean, we used to have a lot of high-end goods in terms of kitchen appliances. We have this Swedish company, Electrolux, which is pretty big internationally. But due to the Swedish tax system and the strong position of the Sweden labor unions and the free market, of course, we have too little protectionism, I think. They have been forced to move most of their production abroad, primarily to Asia. And the same thing goes for cars. I mean, we used to have two really high-quality Swedish car brands, Volvo and Saab, which was internationally famous for their quality. And I would say basically on the same level as Audi, Mercedes, and BMW. Well, maybe not BMW, but not far away from there. They are not even Swedish owned anymore. They are owned by the Volvo is owned by the Chinese, and most of the production takes place in China nowadays. So we have pretty much abandoned our entire industry, and in a free market, in a harmonious world, the liberal paradise where everyone gets along, that kind of makes sense. But as soon as you move into some sort of different situation where you actually get into some conflicts with various countries, some of which you actually moved your production plants to, that puts you in a very, very bad situation, because the only thing Sweden pretty much has left now is the service sector. We have a lot of IT companies, we have a lot of call centers, and that's not really what benefits a country if the situation changes internationally, and if you're forced to compete in a more protectionist environment, which I think the world is moving towards eventually, especially when we get some real international conflicts going. So I basically think it's a sound idea to try to maintain your industries in your own country, not only for the advantage of the workers. I mean, that's of course a very big advantage to actually have some industries that are able to give people work. But also for your country as a whole and your country's economy as a whole, because let's imagine, for example, that Sweden and China gets into some sort of diplomatic crisis or some sort of conflict, and 90% of our manufacturing plants are located in China. How can we make sure that they stay in our possession? It's impossible. I mean, they are lost. We have pretty much given away all our machines and all our knowledge and everything, and we would have to start from scratch, building up our entire industry again. And so I'm definitely not a liberal when it comes to this free market ideology. I'm totally for protectionism, and
Well, it's interesting with protectionism is in the United States, it's basically the establishment supports outsourcing and globalization, but both the far right and the far left support protectionism. In the U.S. elections, you have both Bernie Sanders on one side and Donald Trump on the other talking about protectionism.
And that is what actually makes me, I mean, I don't like Bernie Sanders very much, but I would have to say that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are pretty much the only close to honest politicians. I actually like Trump a lot. I like Bernie Sanders a lot less, but still he's much better than Hillary Clinton, for example. She's like totally corrupt. She's totally a slave to the bankers and to the various corporations. If I have to say something good about Bernie Sanders, it's that he's at least somewhat.
He wants to model. He said he wants to model the United States after Sweden.
Well, okay, I like him a lot less now after hearing this. actually, now I hate him. Now I hate Bernie Sanders. So forget everything positive I said about him. He's an evil man, and I hope he loses. I'm quite sure he does. I'm quite sure Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic candidate, and I think she will lose. As long as Donald Trump will be the Republican candidate, which I actually think there is a chance he will be, because he's so popular and he's so charismatic, and the other candidates are so horrible. they are a total joke. I've been watching a lot of these debates, and they have nothing. I mean, I've been saying this, and I am one of the few people, I know that I'm not American, I'm a Swedish person, so many people probably think that, well, what the hell does this guy know about American politics, but I have some interest in American politics since the U.S. is a superpower and affects the rest of the world, so therefore, I'm quite interested in American politics, and I've been following a lot of these debates. And I have to say that the other Republican candidates they really have nothing. I mean, to compete with Donald Trump, which makes me very happy, because Donald Trump seems, well, he's obviously not perfect. He has a lot of flaws, but I think he's the best available candidate at the moment that actually has a real chance of becoming president. I don't know, what is your take on that as an American?
Yeah, I mean, I basically agree. He has a lot of flaws, but if you have to compare him to everyone else running, I mean, he's basically the only option that we got. If you look at who else he's running against. I want to point something else out about you have a chapter, you get into economics, and you talk about the concept of wealth redistribution, and this is obviously happening in the United States as well, but you make the argument that wealth has been redistributed from the middle class to both the foreign lumpen proletariat at the bottom and the financial plutocracy at the very top.
Yes, and that is definitely what has happened. At least in Europe. Maybe the situation is different in the U.S. I don't know if you disagree with me.
It's the same, basically.
It's the same, yeah.
Yeah, we basically have the same thing going on.
And that is obviously a bad thing, because the middle class is kind of the core of society. They are it's kind of the basis for a functional society. So redistribution from them to the lumpen proletariat and various minorities included in that category, and the absolute elite is very much a bad thing in my view.
What else in your book that I haven't touched upon that you would like to share with our audience?
Well, I would really like to recommend that chapter about gender roles. I don't know what your reaction to that chapter is, but that's probably the most controversial chapter. I mean, even within the right, because a lot of people who consider themselves part of the true right still subscribe to some of these crazy feminist ideas of, like, gender equality, the ideal of gender parity in the movement, and so forth. So what I write in this chapter is probably very controversial, not only to the left, but also to large portions of the right. So I'm very curious to hear what your reaction to that chapter is and what your take on my views on these positions are.
I think it's the thing is with men and women is that women are much more conformist. So men are more likely to make bold risks. So that you see it with men. You see men at the very at sort of both extremes. You see men leading most like dissident movements. You see men at the top of society, but also you see men at the bottom of the society. Like most of the most difficult jobs, like say coal miners, you see men doing. So I don't think that it's necessary. I don't think you can really expect men and women to play the same role if they have they are very different psychologically and biologically. You make a lot of the same arguments that I've been hearing. I just maybe just take it like more extreme. A lot of people maybe want to water down their message because they don't want to. They're worried about maybe alienating. There are women out there who are sympathetic to their message, and they don't want to alienate them.
But the funny thing is that I was pretty sure when I wrote this chapter, which by the way was the most enjoyable chapter to write because I thought it was a lot of fun to write these controversial statements. But I totally expected like a storm of criticism from various women on our side, if you will. But on the contrary, I received quite a lot of praise from especially women. For this chapter, because the most common opinion I hear from them is that, well, finally someone dares to say these obvious things that everyone should adhere to. What you said before, I mean, that men are overrepresented at the absolute top as well as the bottom. I mean, that is very easily explained by both our propensity to take risks, where we differ from women, who are less likely to take risks, but also because of the different bell curves. I mean, the male bell curve is like more, it's wider, it's wider and lower, while the female bell curve is more like narrow and higher. I mean, you have a larger concentration towards the middle. So the majority of women are kind of clustered in the middle. I mean, they are average in IQ, while men are less clustered in the middle. We have more male geniuses and we have more male retards, basically, and that's why we see more men who are total losers. I mean, they are homeless and they have to do very, very hazardous and menial and degrading jobs, more so than women. But we also see men overrepresented in like CEO positions. And the funny thing about feminism is that they only tend to focus on this
aspect.
But yeah, they never complain about we should have more female homeless persons or
more women in prison, make it so the prison population is 50-50.
Yeah, exactly. They are only after like the CEO positions and the corporate boards and so forth.
Before I wrap it up, one more thing I will add about the topic of feminism is that on one hand, Sweden is probably the most feminist country in the world, but they're also importing cultures that are the most least feminist cultures in the world at the same time. There's that contradiction.
Yeah, and the Swedish feminists, which are probably the most radical feminists in the whole world, which made it even more enjoyable for me to write this chapter, because I published this book in Swedish first before the English edition came out. I really tried to put some of the most controversial ideas of this chapter out there, available on the web and on Twitter, with all the most popular feminist hashtags to kind of really provoke the Swedish feminist community, which is hilarious. I mean, I got pretty much a total hate storm from Swedish feminists during the last few days. A very stupid hate storm with lack of arguments and lots of insults. But anyway, it had a lot of entertainment value for me. Back to your question, I mean, the feminists, you have to understand that there are a very, very rigid, politically correct hierarchy, within the ideology of cultural Marxism, and that means that white men are at the absolute bottom, of course. White women are slightly above, but above them we have all the minorities, so which means that if you're politically correct, for example, if you're a feminist, you can't really criticize any Muslims for being oppressive towards women. So they totally neglect the
I think in the United States it's there with the issue. I think with the issue of Islam, it's in Sweden, I think it's definitely taboo to criticize Islam. I actually think in the United States, like, Bill Maher, not sure if you're familiar with him, he's a prominent comedian. He's very, very liberal, but he's also very critical of Islam on a show on HBO.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the U.S. is, when it comes to free speech, the U.S. is much better country than Sweden, because you actually allow some level of political incorrectness, and Sweden, there are within the mainstream media there are zero tolerance towards politically incorrect views, and which makes our popular culture very boring and very predictable, and. But when it comes to the Swedish feminists, they are completely silent on the topic of Muslim gang rapes of Swedish women, for example, which is happening on a daily basis. They're completely silent and never even raise the topic. They're more concerned with trivial topics like man spreading and most ridiculous things you can think about that they can kind of direct at the Swedish male population, while turning a blind eye towards the more horrible things that are happening within the immigrant communities, which involves gang rapes, honorary killings. It's quite common among, for example, Arabs and then Kurds that they kill their daughters because they've been dating a Swedish man, for example. And we've had a whole quite big amount of those kind of killings in Sweden. And the feminists never touch on these topics. I mean, they turn a blind eye towards rapes and murders committed by immigrants while making a huge issue about men sitting on the subway with their legs spread too far apart. It kind of says a lot about the stupidity and the total dishonesty about in the Swedish feminist movement.
We are out of time, so I would like to thank Daniel Freeberg for being on. Check out his book, Real Right Returns on Arctos.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Be on your show.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.